Welcome to session number 6 in the Biblical Doctrines of Civil Government. We have finally come to the key text in the New Testament in regard to civil government, Romans chapter 13. The Scottish political historian J.W. Allen stated, "The 13th chapter of the Epistle to the Romans contains what are perhaps the most important words ever written for the history of political thought." Another writer put it this way, "Romans 13 was and is the most troublesome political passage in the New Testament and was responsible for literally millions of words exchanged on the question of political liberty." Unquote. I believe the Romans 13 controversy is likely due to the fact that this text teaches truth that goes against mankind's fallen natural proclivities, his natural reasoning. It takes faith in the active sovereignty of God over the affairs of men to receive correctly the teachings of Romans 13. Romans 13, 1. "Every person is to be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God." In the early church, Christians might have assumed that since their citizenship is in heaven, they might have some sort of diplomatic immunity from the Roman state. The Roman government was idolatrous and pagan, and what has righteousness to do with submitting to unrighteousness? Plus, look at how the Bible describes the empires of man in the prophecies of Daniel. They're beasts. And if they're beasts, certainly we're not supposed to subject ourselves to them, and certainly they couldn't be established by God. But notice how all of those assumptions are corrected in Romans 13. Romans 13 is a crucial chapter given to the church to correct so much political error. At the time this letter was written to the Church of Rome, Nero, one of the most evil emperors in Roman history, was on the throne, AD 54 to AD 68. And yet Paul writes, "Every person is to be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God." Also, in Paul's day, there were the Jewish zealots who worked to overthrow the Roman occupation. They were the prime example of the opposite of the apostolic teaching here in Romans 13. These zealots were sure that they were following the path of the judges in the book of Judges, those judges who are called of God to overthrow the control of the Moabites and the Midianites and the Philistines. So why not overthrow Rome? But according to the prophecies in Daniel, it was God himself that put Israel under the Roman occupation, just as God put Israel under Babylon and King Nebuchadnezzar. Jesus himself didn't advocate for rebellion against Rome. So we see that Romans chapter 13 is radical and counterculture. It is not the political philosophy that the natural mind arrives at. The opening statement is a command. Every person is to be subject to the governing authorities. The word, hupoteso, subjection or submission, is very similar to the word obedience, but it carries with it the idea of a hierarchy of authority. And that's the point the apostle goes on to make, that these governing authorities are hierarchies set up by God. And God establishes government, not man. And that truth flies in the face of popular political ideology. 2 points. First, God created the general institution of government. It wasn't just people sitting around deciding that they needed a ruler to help society run better. Second, the specific individual governments that are set up in this world have been put there by God. The American government, the Brazilian government, the Russian government, the Polish government, all governments are established by God. And the point in verse 1 is, do you see a government that exists? It's been put there by God. It's not as if there are governments set up in the world that have not been put there by God. However, people will look at human circumstances that have brought about certain governments and not seeing or appreciating the hand of God's providence, assume that if a government exists, it's put there by man. In our Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson followed the political philosophy of John Locke rather than the words of the Apostle Paul. Jefferson wrote that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Question: do governments derive their intrinsic authority from the consent of the people or from God? And who establishes or sets up government? That's not some insignificant, hair-splitting theological distinction. Because if man is the one who establishes government, then man, the will of the people, can overthrow government. As the Declaration of Independence goes on to explain, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government. The right of resistance and overthrow were based on the idea that governments derive their power from the consent of the governed rather than by the hand of God. And if man creates government, man can overthrow government. But Romans chapter 13 teaches people are to be in subjection to government because governments that exist are established by God, not man. So therefore, if God establishes government, verse 2, whoever resists the established civil authorities is opposing God, and those who resist will receive God's condemnation. So if man establishes government, man may overthrow government, but if it's the case that God establishes government, man may not overthrow government. And this is historic Christian theology. Then in Romans chapter 13, verses 3 through 4, Paul goes on to give another reason why governments should be obeyed and not opposed, because God sets up governments for our good, whether those governments be just or unjust. Let's take a moment and talk about the political philosophy of John Locke, since he was so influential in American political thought. John Locke, 1632 to 1704, was an English physician and political philosopher, raised in a Puritan family, raised in the church. He wrote two treatises on civil government where he explained his social contract theory of government, where governments come about by men agreeing on a social contract. I will give you the power of the sword. I will be under your authority in exchange for you, the king, protecting my property. This social contract theory was being quoted by Jefferson in our Declaration of Independence. So therefore, whenever a government fails to keep the social contract, it's concluded that the people have a duty to overthrow that government. Now, it is true that from an earthly point of view, it may look as if governments have come about by the choice of men. But Locke was referring to much more than that. He was in effect teaching that the authority of government and the establishment of government originates with man. Now, Locke would affirm that God gives us our rights, and we would give Locke credit for that, but he would veer away from Scripture in teaching that the authority of government comes from man. He taught this to justify the overthrow of corrupt government. Now, don't misunderstand Locke and Jefferson's political philosophy that the people are to consent to or vote on their government and their magistrates is not that far afield. As we discussed in our last session, the Bible allows for a representative republic or what is called popular ascendancy. As in Acts chapter 6, verse 3, select from among yourselves 7 men of good reputation, or Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 13, choose wise and discerning and experienced men from your tribes. But biblically, those officials are still established by God, not by the vote of the people. The vote is only a secondary cause. The primary cause is God. And civil authorities must rule for God, not the people. They get their authority from God, not the people. And they have authority, even if they're put there, by some other earthly means than the vote of the people. The error of Locke and Jefferson and humanistic political philosophers is in teaching that the state gets its intrinsic authority from the people, and the authority of magistrates only comes about by the vote of the people. That is a theological error that opens the door to one nation under man rather than one nation under God. All notable Christian theologians have seen the error in Locke and Jefferson's philosophy. For example, John Murray, the Scottish theologian, one of the founders of Westminster Seminary, in his commentary on Romans 13 writes, "Here it is expressly stated and excludes from the outset every notion to the effect that authority in the state rests upon agreement on the part of the governed or upon the consent of the governed." Now, this does not mean that the American Revolution was a complete sin outside the will of God, but Christians recognize that it was a mixed bag. There were theological confusions and humanistic Enlightenment influences. Benjamin Franklin proposed that the Great Seal of the United States would be the image of the Pharaoh of the Exodus drowning in the Red Sea with the words, "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God." That was the enthusiasm of the revolutionists at that time, but that's not the way of Christ. Another example, the colonial banner called the Hanging of Absalom, where the story of David and Absalom is applied to the American revolutionary cause. But Absalom is portrayed as the colonial patriot who is being persecuted by King George. King David is being represented as the evil tyrant. Absalom, the rebel, is considered the hero of the story. But again, what do the scriptures teach? Romans chapter 13, verse 2, "Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves." At issue is really the sin of rebellion. And this goes beyond political revolution. This is rebellion against God. Now, Locke is considered the father of classic liberalism. Even Wikipedia claims that Locke's writings influenced the secular atheists of the day, Voltaire and Rousseau. And when Locke came out with his social contract theory, he was hailed a genius. Because in that day, on the onset of the secular Enlightenment, any theory that someone could come up with that gave an alternative explanation for some aspect of life that contradicted the Bible, that man was a hero. To give an alternative explanation for sin, there was Freud. An alternative explanation for origins, there was Darwin. For politics, John Locke. For economics, Adam Smith. This was liberalism at its inception. There was an acknowledging of God, deism, but rationalism trumped biblical exposition. Locke was from a Puritan family, and he actually wrote a defense for Christianity called "The Reasonableness of Christianity as Delivered in the Scriptures." But the error of Locke is an error many professing evangelicals fall into in every age, leaving the authority of the Bible and resorting to rationalism superimposed upon the Bible. So rather than actually wrestling with the Romans 13 text, Locke, in his treatise, went to Romans 13 and superficially concluded it could not mean what it says, because he assumed its plain reading would mean Christians would have no recourse against tyrants. Locke's explanation of Romans 13 was that Paul was only addressing good government, lawful authority, not evil government. And that Paul had the reason for being silent about evil government because Paul did not want Christians to be seen by the Romans as being subversive. So as far as dealing with evil government, like Rome, Locke concluded that Christians must fill in the silence of Scripture with their own wisdom. So the objections to Romans chapter 13, then and now, are twofold. First, the text cannot mean all authority is established by God and must be obeyed, because that would substantiate the unpopular medieval teaching called the divine right of kings, that the king's actions are not to be questioned or opposed because everything he does is ordained by God. And second, that Romans 13 cannot mean what it says because it would be teaching that evil government can never be lawfully overthrown. And if that's the case, evil will triumph. Good people would have to live submissively under a totalitarian state. The people could not better themselves or free themselves. So Romans chapter 13 sounds like it's creating a situation where people will become doormats for evil rulers. Well, that would all be true, but for the fact that there is a true God in heaven who punishes and removes corrupt rulers and government. To understand and appreciate Romans chapter 13, one must believe in Jesus Christ's mediatorial rule over the nations. Psalm 75, "For not from the east, nor from the west, nor from the desert comes exaltation, but God is the judge. He puts down one and exalts another." Daniel chapter 4, verse 25, "The Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes." Now, in this process of God taking down evil rulers, not allowing them to rule for so long, God will often use human agency, both people working in obedience to God and people working in disobedience to God. There are biblical allowances for a righteous people to depose evil kings, as we see throughout the book of Judges, and we'll discuss that in a later session. But the point is that God is the one calling the shots, not man. A primary biblical text in this regard is when King David had the opportunity to assassinate King Saul. King Saul was evil. He had ordered the execution of all of the priests of Nob. Anyone with any sense of justice knew that Saul had to go. But what does David say to his commander, who advises David to assassinate Saul? 1 Samuel 26, "But David said to Abishai, 'Do not destroy him. Do not destroy King Saul. For who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt?' David also said, 'As the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, or his day will come that he dies, or he will go down into battle and perish.'" The point is that the removal of the king is God's prerogative. And God can use many different agencies, but it's not to be by the hand of God's people. For Romans 13, government authorities are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority has opposed the ordinance of God. Now, one of the ways people try to get around the meaning of Romans 13, as did John Locke, is by taking the phrase, "those which exist are established by God," as if it's qualified or limited by the phrase in verse 4, "it is a minister of God to you for good." Therefore, it's concluded that only governments that are ministers for good are ordained of God. And therefore, it's only those governments to which we must submit. And therefore, we can also disobey and overthrow governments we believe are not ministers to us for good. That is a very common misinterpretation. But textually, Romans chapter 13, verse 4 is not qualifying or limiting the ruling authorities in verse 1. The qualifier of governmental authorities is right in verse 1. All governments that exist are ordained of God. Does it exist? Then it's established by God. What verse 4 is teaching is that all governments, even evil governments, are still for our good. Notice the famous Presbyterian Westminster Confession of Faith, drawn up in 1646, Article 23. Infidelity on the part of the state or difference in religion from the state does not make void the magistrate's just and legal authority, nor free the people from their due obedience to them, from which ecclesiastical church persons are not exempt. Now, we might reasonably question the teaching of Romans chapter 13 if it was a standalone text. But one thing is for sure, the doctrine of Romans chapter 13 is taught throughout the entire Bible, that God establishes both good and evil governments. Romans chapter 9, verse 17, quoting Exodus chapter 9, "For the scripture says to Pharaoh, for this very purpose I raised you up to demonstrate my power in you." God raised up the evil Pharaoh of the Exodus. Concerning the foreign governments that invaded and occupied Israel, Judges chapter 3, verse 8, God sold them into the hands of the kings of Mesopotamia. Judges chapter 3, verse 12, the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel. Judges 7, 1, the Lord gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Judges 10, 7, the Lord sold them into the hands of the Philistines. And Proverbs 21, 1, the king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, he was no saint. But the prophet Jeremiah told the people, Jeremiah 27, "Now I have given all of these lands into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. All nations shall serve him." The Assyrian government, the empire, was cruel. But in Isaiah 10, we read that Assyria was the rod of God's anger and the staff in whose hand is his indignation. He sent it against a godless nation, and he commissioned it against the people of his fury, to capture booty, to seize plunder, and to trample them down like mud in the streets. In Zechariah chapter 11, verse 15, God says to the prophet, "Take for yourself the equipment of a foolish shepherd. For behold, I am going to raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for the perishing, seek the scattered, heal the broken, or sustain the one standing, but will devour the flesh of the fat sheep." The shepherd there is a reference to a governmental civic leader. Did God raise up Pilate? Pilate thought he was operating independently of God. Pilate thought he had the power of life and death. But Jesus said to Pilate, "You would have no authority over me unless it has been given to you from above." And that's confirmed in Romans chapter 13. Pilate only had authority by God to act. And in Acts chapter 4, God anointed Pilate and Herod. So it's clear that Romans chapter 13 is following the rest of Scripture in teaching that God establishes all government, even evil government, to which we must submit. But not participating in the evil done by such governments, only bearing the punishment, hiding for a little while until indignation runs its course, Isaiah 26. Here's a question. Did God raise up Hitler and Stalin? Of course. Civil leaders can only come to power by the providence of God. And this is where many people have a problem with this biblical doctrine of civil government. And they have a hard time rationally accepting Romans 13 teaching, just as people can't understand the mystery of God allowing evil in the first place. Even the prophet Habakkuk could not understand how God could use the wicked nation of Babylon to judge Israel. Remember Habakkuk's famous statement in Habakkuk chapter 1? He says, "Yes, Lord, you have established them to judge us, but how can you look upon wickedness with favor? How can you use wicked people?" Well, it's quite simple. God uses evil people to judge other evil people. People must drink their own medicine. If a people don't love God and righteousness, they will learn by having to serve the devil. They'll learn the difference between living under God versus living under the devil. 2 Chronicles 12:8. Notice that the Romans 13 text does not say all government is morally good, but all governments are for our good. That might seem like a distinction without a difference, but that is a well-attested biblical distinction. It harkens back to Genesis chapter 50, verse 12, where Joseph's brothers sell him into slavery. But Joseph eventually says back to them, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for our good." The actions of Joseph's brothers was a heinous evil, but God was using that evil for the good of his people. Evil government will help God's people by judging unbelievers, by bringing down an evil people, by driving an evil populace, an evil nation off the cliff. Evil rulers will test our faith and obedience. They will help us to rearrange our priorities. They will even give us a greater witness for Christ. As Paul writes in Philippians chapter 1, verse 12, that by being arrested, Paul was able to witness to the entire Praetorian Guard. Even the martyrdom of Christians in the Roman arena proclaimed the glories of Christ to the Roman people. The blood of the saints is the seed of the church. People just don't understand biblically what we need and what is good. That's why Romans 13 is not properly received by so many. To receive Romans 13, one must first have a genuine belief and trust in God, that He rules over the nations, that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. May Jesus Christ reign.